God is not afraid of new things. That is the message of Pope Francis, the words from his homily yesterday. The Catholic Church has just completed a synod, which is a big meeting of bishops on family issues, as they put it. We're going to have more on that synod that some are calling extraordinary in just a few minutes here on Minnesota Public Radio News. But first, we're going to get an update on the ongoing story concerning the Catholic Church here in the Twin Cities. A week ago, victims' attorney Jeff Anderson announced a settlement with the St. Paul Minneapolis Archdiocese and the Winona Diocese, too, in a landmark case involving clergy sex abuse, that is. The deal was complex. It left many people with a lot of questions about why Anderson would settle the case the way he did. NPR News reporter Madeline Barron has an extensive story that will be online later today about what happened behind the scenes on this settlement. She's been covering this for us and joins us now on the Daily Circuit with a bit more. Thanks, Madeline, for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
So what can you tell us about this? Because if I remember right, it was a pretty sudden announcement of a settlement last week, right?
Right. You recall last week, Anderson appeared at a PAC news conference and shook hands with church officials and even brought sex abuse survivors on stage to shake the hands of church officials. And he announced what he called 17 historic child protection protocols agreed to by church officials. But most of them aren't new. And all of this surprised a lot of people because Anderson has been so outspoken in the past about warning the public not to be distracted by policies and promises. And now he's holding them up as this new way forward.
Do you have a sense of why he's doing this?
The Archdiocese has a lot of power right now, Tom, and at any moment they could file bankruptcy and drag the settlement process on for years. And many survivors would then potentially receive much lower settlements as a result. We're seeing this play out exactly this way in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, where Anderson's law firm has been in this protracted 3-year battle with the church over bankruptcy. And so far in that case, no one other than the church's lawyers have gotten paid.
Now, we should say about this lawsuit, as you have been reporting, that there was a somewhat unique strategy to it. He was trying to make the case that the church was, in fact, a public nuisance here, right? And he was able as well to get testimony under oath, depositions from some pretty high-level church leaders in the diocese, right?
Right, because he wasn't just saying they were negligent. He was saying they've created this, basically this public safety risk by keeping information about abusive priests secret. He was able to get documents for the past, since all the way back from the 70s, all the way up to a couple of months ago. And like you said, take the depositions of these top officials who are usually off limits in these cases.
People like Archbishop Neinstedt himself and former Archbishop Harry Flynn.
Exactly.
And others. So when we hear about a settlement, usually there's a deal involved, and often, and assuming in this case it involves money, what do we know about this deal and what don't we still yet?
What I found out is that there's a third agreement that has not been made public. And when I talked to Anderson later last week, he referred to it as the agreement behind the agreement. And according to Anderson's law firm, it says the church will follow the child protection protocols that were released last week, but it doesn't say how they'll be enforced. And another attorney at Anderson's law firm, Mike Finnegan, told me that this agreement was signed on behalf of all of their current clients. But he said that it doesn't settle any of those cases of those clients. And he said that the law firm only informed one of its clients before signing this agreement.
Now, what are you hearing from the victims of clergy sex abuse about this deal?
Many people I talk with said they're confused about why Anderson would take this approach, why he'd shake hands with officials from an organization he's accused of carrying out a criminal conspiracy. And for many of them, it's hard to criticize Anderson. They really look up to him and see him as a hero for 3 decades of relentless pursuit of abusers and those who covered up their abuse. But I am hearing from survivors that are hurt by Anderson's statements that this is a new day and that the church is now sincere about the promises that it's made for decades. They don't believe it.
Madeline Barron, who has been covering the clergy sex abuse story for us here on Minnesota Public Radio News, thanks, as always, for your details and insight.
You're welcome.
There is more online, or there will be, from Madeline at nprnews.org and later on All Things Considered here on Minnesota Public Radio News. 11:11, we continue with the Daily Circuit. We're going to get some analysis now on what I mentioned right at the top of the show, what came out of the Synod of the Catholic Church that ended yesterday. The 2-week-long gathering of bishops at the Vatican discussed matters of family, marriage, divorce, and homosexuality. reports from earlier in the week, it was a two-week event, they signaled that annulment and perhaps a welcome of homosexuals to the church would be included. And then the final report fell short of some of those expectations of more progressive Catholics, while conservatives were wary of some of the language in earlier drafts. Dennis Cody joins me now. He's the editor of the National Catholic Reporter. His organization has been reporting extensively on the Synod, and he joins me now from Kansas City. Dennis Cody, welcome to Minnesota Public Radio. Good to have you here.
Glad to be with you this morning.
So first off, I just want to explain, get a definition or two about this synod and others like it that have happened in the history of the church. What are they? What happens at them?
Well, a synod is a gathering of bishops. It was instituted by the Second Vatican Council, which was the big historic church meetings in the mid-60s. And it calls together bishops from around the world to meet on specific topics and to advise the Pope. That's it in a nutshell. And there's two kinds. One is called an extraordinary synod, and that's what this was.
Okay.
And this is – it has a little bit different makeup. It has the representatives from national bishops' conferences and people appointed by the Pope. And they take on a special consulting role. And then there's also just an ordinary synod, and that's what we're going to be seeing next year. And so this synod this year is really preparation for the synod that will come next year.
So it sounds like these gatherings are relatively routine in the goings-on of the church.
Yes. You know, it's funny because my newspaper, National Catholic Reporter, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary. Actually, next week, the 28th, is our official 50th anniversary.
Congratulations.
So our paper was – thank you. Our paper was really born in the foment of the time of the Second Vatican Council. And doing research for that, I found that when the synod system was launched back by Pope Paul VI, some of the commentators at that point were calling it almost a senate of bishops, almost like a legislative body that would have a direct action, a direct input into what the Pope and the Roman Curia would be saying about church practice and laws. It didn't quite meet that level of engagement, unfortunately, our newspaper would say unfortunately, but it has been an ongoing series of meetings held every 2, 3, or 4 years on specific topics. Most of them end up being pretty routine. There's a meeting, there's a document issued, sometimes a year to 18 months after the actual meeting happens. And they become just pretty much talking shops, and not much comes from them.
And like a Senate, which you compared it to sort of loosely there, there was a vote here, right? I understand the bishops voted on the final draft of the document to be released, right?
Yes, yes. And not the vote itself, because there's always some kind of voting going on. But what made this synod extra special was that the way Pope Francis introduced it and conducted it. And he said at the very beginning that he wanted this to be a bold discussion of ideas, and he wanted debate.
And he said
he
wanted frank speaking as well, if I remember reading it. And one of the more striking things, and I may not have this exactly right, but that I read early on is that there was actually a longtime married Catholic couple there actually testifying about their love lives, their sexual desire for each other, how important this was to their marriage. And I think a lot of people thought the idea of this couple speaking so frankly about their sex lives in front of a bunch of celibate bishops just may appear just slightly surreal, but is that as you understand it as it happened?
Yes, there were 14 couples who were brought in over the course of the two-week period to address the Synod Fathers, as they're called. The Australian couple made a pretty dramatic intervention, and their statement was released, and they got the frank talk that Francis asked for. I mean, they were very, very clear about their adherence to church teachings and their belief in church doctrine, and yet they talked from their heart about their experiences living with broken families, living within parish communities with couples who are of same-sex orientation, and the practical implications of living in that kind of environment.
Now, there were headlines last week, and that was, I suppose, a draft document. Is it fair to say that there was a softer, more welcome tone on a couple of issues, and that is concerning homosexuality, especially same-sex couples, and also divorced and remarried Catholics. And what prompted those headlines, do you think, that we might be seeing and hearing a softer tone, and some people maybe went so far as to say perhaps some church changes here?
Again, speaking from the perspective of my newspaper, I wouldn't call it a softer tone, but I think it was an acknowledgement of the reality of the current situation. You know, and that is in those the hot button issues that were discussed were that brought the headlines were the acknowledgement of homosexuality, you know, calling it a gift and something to be respected and to draw out what the goodness from that. A similar kind of statement about cohabitation, you know, living together without being married, saying that there are good things that can come from that kind of relationship. And so what we saw that document doing is it really made the church a listening church, a recognition of the reality that people live with day to day. And the bishops, they heard those stories, they listened to them, and they said, this is what we're going to talk about.
As you see it, is that more in keeping with the narrative that we're beginning to hear about Pope Francis, perhaps a more pastoral, a more merciful tone than we may have seen with previous popes? At least that's what's often reported.
Again, what I would stress would not be so much the merciful tone, okay, because we can go back to earlier pontificates and see statements of mercy. But what has struck us in our reporting of this event is the level of actual discussion and dialogue and disagreement over important questions that we have heard. That's what has impressed us, because for the first time in 35 years, church people at that level have been allowed to disagree with each other in public and discuss matters of acute importance to the church, and not have agreement, and not have to pretend that they're in unanimous agreement on some of these issues. And that's what I found most startling and most inviting. The languages, as we saw, the language that came out a week ago was welcome and open and inviting. That has been dialed back. We've made specific references now to church teaching that talks about homosexuality as being intrinsically disordered. We kind of expected to see some dial back on those kind of issues. But I think the important thing is, and Francis also addressed this in his talk at this end of the Synod, is that these ideas were talked about. And that's very clear in the documents, even the final document. And we see it even in the voting. And so that's what gives me the most hope.
Now, according to the New York Times, as they characterize it, they say that Pope Francis, in his final talk, I'm unclear, is that a sermon or would he just speak to the group?
It was just an address to the group.
Address to the group, but he cautioned apparently against a hostile rigidity by so-called traditionalists. At the same time, cautioned progressives who would bandage a wound before treating it. So, as you see that, what is the Pope doing there? If the New York Times has that correct,
right? Yeah, that's straight out of his talk on last Saturday afternoon. And what he's doing is the other part in there that says a similar kind of thing is that he's saying, you know, we cannot neglect the deposit of faith. You know, he calls himself a loyal son of the church and a firm believer in church doctrine. And he doesn't, he doesn't want to see any change in that. That's not what his agenda is. He doesn't like to see himself as a reformer. But he also says in that same talk, he says the other temptation is to neglect reality. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's where we are. He's really walking a thin line. The other quote that we use a lot with Pope Francis is that he likes this messiness in the church. And that's what we're seeing played out, because it's in the confrontation of the reality, looking and seeing and observing how people actually live their lives, faithful Catholics who have trouble with church teachings, to see how they deal with that in their own personal lives, reflect on what the church teaching is, and then from those two reflections to come out with a church practice. I think that's what Francis' agenda is. That's what he is about.
We're talking with Dennis Cody, who is the editor of the National Catholic Reporter, about the Synod on Family Issues, as they put it, that took place and just ended this weekend at the Vatican, a two-week meeting of bishops from around the church discussing, among other things, as we've been saying, as you put it, Dennis, the messiness of, as compared to strict church teaching, the way a lot of Catholics and people around the world live their lives. That's our discussion this morning on the Daily Circuit here on Minnesota Public Radio News. And and I know you just addressed this, but I want to hear a little more from you about how you think this synod fits into the papacy of Francis so far.
I think if what happens is what we think the goal of Francis is with this, is to remake the synod structures. I think this will be looked at as his primary gift to the church, his papacy, is to make the synod structure function as Paul VI and the bishops at the Second Vatican Council envisioned the synod body to operate. And that is a true consultative body from the grassroots of the church. Because what the synod is supposed to do is supposed to bring together bishops who aren't in Roman offices. Okay, they're not. Mm-hmm. They have their own offices back in their own diocese, but they're really pastoral men in the grassroots of the church who are engaged with their people, listening to their people. And another Francis quote, you know, that has the smell of the sheep on them, to bring them to Rome at critical times to look at specific issues and to advise the full church what the practice should be. And again, I think that's what Francis is headed toward. And if he can achieve that aspect of it, I think that's going to be the major achievement of his papacy.
Now, a lot of the American press and the secular press from around the world like to look at this the way they look at secular politics. You know, secular politics, you've got conservatives, you've got liberals. You want a winner, you want a loser. You want even sometimes you want a conflict, right? And so sometimes this is painted as Francis versus the conservatives. But is that really the way things work in the church or are working here?
You know, the liberal conservative tags don't quite fit the analogy closely. But I think the one thing the synod did reveal is that there is a division in the church. You know, there are people that, again, to use my editorial perspective, you know, in Francis's words, you know, there is some hostile inflexibility within the church. And there are other people that are looking for that to embrace more of the mercy aspect of the church. And so those divisions were very clear in this synod. And I think going forward, that's what we're going to see play out in the grassroots. Because remember, what they're supposed to do with this document, it continues to be a working document that is supposed to be discussed and analyzed and studied again back at the grassroots levels of the church. Because the bishops have to go back again a year from now and rediscuss these issues and come up with a final statement that could hint at some changes in church practices.
And as you look ahead to that, I suppose it's slightly unfair for me to ask you to prognosticate or crystal ball, but if you were to see changes, might those changes come based on what we saw out of this synod?
You know, I honestly do not know.
Really?
Because of those divisions that we're going to see, and we're going to see it discussed. You know, immediately in this country, because this is the United States is where I know the best because I see that media, stuff like that.
Sure.
As soon as this working document was released a week ago, there were U.S. bishops already stepping up and saying, no.
Now, wait a minute.
The media is misinterpreting what's going on here, you know, that this is not – there's nothing final here. Church doctrine has not changed. You know, so already we're seeing in this country, and I imagine it's happening in other countries, we're seeing bishops starting to take positions and starting to line themselves up. And that there are a faction within the church that does not want to see any change at all. The lead on that has emerged as a Cardinal Raymond Burke, a bishop originally from La Crosse, Wisconsin, later Archbishop of St. Louis. He's now a Vatican curial official in the Supreme Court, and he has been very adamant about the church doctrine, church practices cannot change. There will be no change in the law on divorced and remarried Catholics. There will be no acceptance of homosexuality within the church. He's very clear on that. And there are bishops who are lining up in kind of that camp, into that faction.
There was a development concerning Cardinal Burke that I read on your website, the National Catholic Reporter, over the weekend, that he also was, in fact, relieved of his job there as, I think it's fair to say, sort of chief justice within the Vatican. What can you tell us about that and why he would have been? What does that signal?
Well, he has confirmed there were rumors that he was going to be removed from the post of kind of like Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for the Church Court.
Yeah.
There were rumors that he was going to be removed from that position. Actually, there was an interview with BuzzFeed last Friday that they asked him that directly, and he said yes, that he has been told that, although there is no official notification yet. And then our reporter in Rome, Josh McElwee, on Saturday, in a street-side interview, got a hold of Cardinal Burke and asked him about it, and he said, yes, it is true that he is moving on.
And didn't he answer when someone asked, well, where did the word come from? He said, who do you think it came from? I'm assuming means the Pope, right?
Yes, that's the quote, and that's the assumption, yes.
And what does that say? What does that tell us that this, as you identified him as sort of a hardline traditionalist, would be relieved by Pope Francis?
Well, again, it's been a two-step process because Cardinal Burke lost a job at the Vatican 1 year ago, last December, when he had a position on the Congregation of Bishops, and that's the Bishops Committee that decides who the new bishop is going to be in whatever territory throughout the world. He sat on that and was a very powerful, influential voice on that congregation. Francis removed him from that post a year ago, and so this is kind of the second step in the process of removing Burke from the influences that he's had in the Vatican.
And finally,
what it says is that he's not in line with the kind of pope, the kind of bishop and pastoral leader that Francis wants in the church.
And what kind would that be, as you see it?
Well, again, what it is, it's someone who is has the smell of the sheep on him, who is in line with what the people are living and practicing and believing at the grassroots level, to be involved with that, to take the church to the periphery, to be the church of the poor. Mercy is very much a theme of Pope Francis. And I think if you look at some of Cardinal Burke's statements over the last couple of years, he is not a big fan of mercy. He's much more of a rigidist, someone that's going to see the enforcement of law as that's how he would define the church as moving forward in that keeping the law.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Cody, the editor of the National Catholic Reporter, I can't thank you enough for all of your insight into this church meeting, this synod, this extraordinary synod, right, or extraordinary synod, as they called it. And we look forward to, I'm sure, talking with you in the future as things progress. And thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's Dennis Cody, editor of the National Catholic Reporter, speaking to us from Kansas City, where the newspaper and website are based.